Makeshift Stories presents Somewhere, Sometime, an irregular series of short bedtime tales and modern fables.
Just a reminder, the stories in Somewhere, Sometime are not serial and can be heard in any order. With the first moon landings in the late 1960s, many may have felt that a Mars mission was not too far off. But since that time, no humans have ever left near Earth orbit. So, sit back and open your imagination as we listen to Makeshift Stories 36, Lifeboat. Somewhere and sometime, humans will live and work on Mars.
The thrusters cut out with a rude jolt that Captain Rashmi Chopra felt deep in his stomach. He unstrapped his harness, then gently pushed the control panel aside, allowing himself to float free of the acceleration couch and over to the side portal to look out. Behind the Mars Piloted Lander, or MPL, the tallest metallic outcrops of Phobos Base struggled to rise just far enough above the lip of Stickney Crater to catch a glint of the distant sun. Despite the diminutive size of the tiny moon, Phobos Base looked to Rashmi like a fragile shard that could be easily missed if one didn't know exactly where to look. The base had been their home for the last 6 months, while final assembly of the landing vehicle had been completed, with the crucial avionics system that had arrived with them from Earth. Rashmi didn't envy the base crew, who could only rotate home every 2 years when Earth and Mars approached that point when their orbits brought them closest together. Phobos Base had been the pride of India's space program. Everyone thought it was the final step toward the ultimate prize, the first human Mars landing and a permanent presence on the red planet's arid surface. But now, on the downward slope of its dominance, the India Space Research Organization, or ISOR, was being forced to reluctantly share its prize. Once again, growing tensions in Central Asia had diverted the nation's interest away from the cosmos. At a crucial point in the Mars program, the ISOR had been forced, cap in hand, to turn to China for help. And now, the glory of this greatest of all adventures, on the eve of the 200th anniversary of the first American moon landing, was a multinational effort. Rashmi had grown up feeding on stories overwhelming with national pride of India's accomplishments in human space exploration. As a teen, he'd been devoted to the wildly popular Bollywood musical series Chanda that had actually been shot on the moon in India's first lunar base just before it was decommissioned after the opening of the much larger Shar-2 in the Sea of Rains. That had been the golden age of human space exploration, and events in the world had come full circle again. Almost as predictably as the phases of the moon, India was losing its commitment. A similar set of circumstances that had resulted in the loss of interest in space in the mid-20th century and had led the Americans to cancel the final moon missions now dominated the subcontinent. Shar-2 was almost 150 million kilometers behind them now, and the presence of Chen, Wei, and the others was a testament to the current conditions on Earth. The barren gray surface of Phobos drifted out of view of the portal as the MPL fired its maneuvering thrusters to start its descent through the thin Martian atmosphere. Rashmi made a final last-minute check of the systems in the so-called pilot's module, then put the controls back into standby. The descent was automated, controlled by computers. He'd only take over in an emergency. It was a 200-year-old legacy inherited from the dawn of space exploration, and most astronauts hated it. Rashmi shrugged off his momentary impulse to shut off the auto-guidance system, turned, and pushed off the wall toward the narrow connector ring into the main crew cabin.
Everything check out? First Officer Wei inquired as Rashmi floated into the cramped space. In between the tangle of ducts, display consoles, and equipment racks, the engineers had managed to squeeze in 4 seats, which were now concealed beneath the bulk of the spacesuit it crew. The orange suit sported the bright mission patch and the flags of each respective occupant's country. Looking around, Rashmi was glad that they wouldn't have to spend much time in this sardine can. He promptly called for the final station check.
Comms, go. Propulsion, go. Ground base guidance beam, go. Avionics, go.
Wei calmly replied. Okay. Once I strap in, tell Phobos we are go. And with that, Rashmi returned to the forward pilot's position. As soon as he had belted himself in and swung the pilot's console back in place, he heard Wei radio the all clear. The MPL abruptly pivoted, presenting the cone of its main engine spinward against the direction of Phobos's orbit. Rashmi felt himself being pushed back into the cushioning of his seat as the craft began its slowdown burn. All he had to do was sit back, and in 20 minutes he and his four companions would step out onto the dusty surface of Mars, hopefully near the ground base that the Phobos technicians had built remotely from orbit. Anya had been born at New Greenland Station. The isolated settlement had been named by her grandparents after the Great Northern Island that had become an archipelago after all its glacial cover had melted. Some of the original founders and backers of the station had made their fortunes there, developing the new wealthy city-states that now peppered the southern ring islands. At 8, she was one of the youngest of the base's current crop of children. It wasn't a bad place to grow up, she mused. The adults were generally too busy with their work to pay too much attention to the kids who freely roamed the complex. Anya's favorite place was the plant biology labs. She liked to help Lenora Petrov, the lab's director, who worked on Arctic vegetation. Lenora would enlist Anya to count the healthy lichen from the various environment tanks that littered the sprawling lab. It wasn't as boring as that might seem. Anya liked the idea that these tiny symbionts of fungus and algae might someday colonize a cold world, slowly changing it to make it more habitable. She loved seeing the intricate and delicate shapes in their endless variety through the microscope as she counted the healthy ones in the samples that Lenora provided. Lenora was slowly hardening the stubborn life forms to tolerate even colder temperatures, high doses of ultraviolet light, and carbon dioxide. Over time, the adults had blurred the distinction between New Greenland Station and the project named Lifeboat, simply referring to everything as the latter. When Anya was younger, she found this confusing, but grew to realize that the entire lives of her parents and grandparents had been spent working on Lifeboat in total isolation from the rest of humanity. The project had been the brainchild of a number of ultra-wealthy private interests. In the midst of the turmoil, fear, and pessimism that had gripped the world during the first great ecological crisis in the middle of the last century, this elite group of investors had started looking for alternatives and had decided to set up a secret remote research facility to find them. They had recruited the best up-and-coming minds before they were well-known. Enthusiasm for and belief in the Lifeboat project was so great among the recruited that they willingly went into total isolation. The project investors had created a discreet army of agents who covered up the apparent disappearances and kept any information about the project from publicly surfacing. And so, for almost a century now, they had labored on ways to create a new utopian world. After a dispute between the project's lead scientists and key investors, the founders had simply walked away. Speculation was that as the world's environment looked like it would settle down, the founding investors had decided that their money would be better spent on something with more immediate returns. It was thought that they believed that without their support, New Greenland and the Lifeboat project would simply dry up and blow away in the dust. But just the opposite had happened.
Using its own discoveries, New Greenland had become self-sustaining, growing in size to almost 500 people, and achieving an ever-increasing level of technological sophistication. Existing, for all intents and purposes, outside of the mainstream of human history, the New Greenlanders had watched for the better part of the last century as bystanders, and became even more determined to create something new, and above all to remain independent and hidden until the right conditions emerged. Today there wasn't much work in the lab. Most of the staff had gone to watch the news program on the Mars landing. The Indo-Chinese project had caused much heated discussion around the station. No one was in favor of seeing the nearly pristine little world start down the same road as the struggling Earth. There had even been talk of coming out of hiding to oppose the mission. Something had been planned, but Anya hadn't paid any attention to it. So, with her work completed, she decided to hide in the truck, scheduled to go out to the new site that the adults had unsuccessfully tried to hide. It would be a coup, one that she could boast to her friends about. Chen turned away from the viewport after the MPL pulsed several brief bursts from its forward maneuvering thrusters to rotate its main engine in preparation for the descent burn. He had been on Mars for over a year, supervising the robotic assembly of his country's contribution to the Human Mars Exploration Mission, ICEDIS Base, which was named for the crater that it was located in. The large ancient sand dune clogged crater had been of interest ever since the discovery of magnesium carbonate in the Giant's Basin. The simple existence of the material hinted at a watery Martian past that was not too acidic for life to have formed. And, like rumors of gold, it had attracted a rush of robotic missions, starting with the ill-fated Beagle almost 2 centuries ago. Most of these had failed, leaving the basin littered with wind-worn robotic junk. The little useful data that did manage to be collected only whetted scientific appetites for more. This was to be the ultimate mission, a massively expensive fossil hunt by human exopaleontologists. The stakes were high. The world, again edging into another crisis, was watching this Indo-Chinese joint venture, and Cheng suspected many secretly hoped for its failure. He knew there wouldn't be another chance, at least not in his lifetime. Although only 15 had been originally planned, it had eventually taken 20 Long March 18 launches to ferry the components of the research base to ICEDIS Planitia. There had been 5 unexpected incidents, where the cargo capsules had simply wandered off course and disappeared into the endless red sand dunes. To cover up these events, the official number of required flights had been publicly altered to 20, with a vague explanation about underestimated cargo capacity. Then, it had taken almost a year to robotically recover the scattered parts, drag them to a central location, and assemble the base. Working from Phobos, Chen and his team had struggled with constant, mysterious communication dropouts to control the surface robots during construction. But finally, the task had been completed. Now, all of his team had left to make room for the Indian engineers needed to assemble the landing vehicle. Despite the failure of several quarter-scale models, which, like the cargo vehicles, had disappeared somewhere on the surface outside of the intended landing area, the navigation problems had apparently been resolved. This cleared the way for the assembly of the full-scale vehicle, the one that was now headed to the surface. Everything, every system, every subsystem, and every backup had been tested multiple times. They couldn't be too careful. And now, all the lander had to do was follow the beacon broadcast by the base to its source, like a moth to a flame. Still, given the unexplained guidance issues, Chen had some reservations. Chen temporarily blanked these concerns from his mind, pushed away from the portal and carefully floated in the microgravity of the tiny moon down the main corridor away from the observation lounge to Phobos control. He quietly slipped into his station at the back and initiated the wake-up sequence. He imagined, unseen below, the startup of propellant manufacturing, life support, and other vital systems as the station began to come alive. Soon, his creation would have its first tenants. The status board glowed green. Rashmi looked out of the small forward viewport. Already, the pink, orange, and blue of superheated gases were lapping around the tough skin of the ship. He had experienced this many times on Earth re-entry, but here the air braking was decidedly weaker in the ultra-thin atmosphere. They were entering into the period early space agencies had coined the 6 minutes of terror, that point at which all the mission specialists could do on Earth was cross their fingers and hope that their delicate craft had made it from orbital speeds to touchdown without creating a crater. They were still traveling at nearly 4 kilometers per second, and in a very short period of time the MPL would have to come to a gentle rest. The thought of the energies involved, the speed at which things had to happen, and the precise timing of it all made Rashmi quiver. He eyed the manual controls again. The pilot's position was more for reassurance than a practical option should things go wrong, and despite his instinct to take control, he knew how desperate things would have to get before he even dared to try. The MPL was on an extremely shallow descent that would make them skip across what there was of an atmosphere, like a flat stone skipping across a pond, until they slowed down to Mach 5 or so. Next came the tricky part. To make the transition from hypersonic to subsonic, the computers would explosively deploy an inflatable cone just at the right millisecond, then discard it a few heartbeats later, rotate the craft for vertical landing, and fire up the propulsion system, all before Mars gravity clawed them from the sky. Only after that point would an intervention by the pilot make any difference. And, of course, all throughout the whole process, the computers would make continual adjustments to the descent angle and hull geometry to keep on beacon from Isidus Station. The physics of the landing had pushed the engineering teams to the limit and made every gram count. So there was no room for surface vehicles, which meant that they had to land within a few kilometers of the station. A miss would be lethal. Rashmi tried to push the complexity of it all from his mind and watched the readouts. For one brief moment, the guidance beacon flickered and went out. He felt his heart leap into his throat as he hovered his hand over the manual control. But an eye blink later, the indicator flashed and came back on, stronger than before. He chalked it up to interference from the ionized Martian air burning around the craft and tried to slow his breathing again. Chen thought he saw a blip in the guidance control system as the MPL entered the upper atmosphere. It may have just been the lander, momentarily knifing through a thicker pocket of air before being entirely enveloped in the hot plasmas that were now wrapping it in a fireball that no radio signal could penetrate. Chen said nothing, and apprehensively waited as the Phobos operations screen flashed up the 180-second count until the MPL would emerge and deploy the hypercone to slow it to subsonic speeds. The window for error was extremely small. 5 seconds at Mach 7 would mean, Chen quickly did the calculation in his head, 11.9 kilometers, and that would be starting to push the ability of the landing crew to reach the base on foot. The Isidus rovers had a range of 100 kilometers, so in case the landing missed its mark, they could retrieve the crew any further off target, and all bets were off. Chen tried to reassure himself. That gave them roughly a 200-kilometer-wide circle to land in. To date, except in cases of catastrophic failure, no landing had ever been that inaccurate. Only 100 seconds had elapsed
when the control room issued a collective gasp of surprise. The lander had dropped to hypersonic speeds much sooner than calculated. But this was what the beacon was for, Chen knew. The onboard nav computers would see their position, then adjust the deployment of the hypercone, so the MPL's remaining kinetic energy would shed more slowly and put them back on course. Then, Chen saw the cone deployment confirmation on the main screen and noticed a flurry of concerned activity around the flight dynamics console. Even in the subdued green light of the operations room, Chen saw the color drain from the flight director's face. She adjusted her headset and spoke.
Phobos Ops to MPL, over.
There was a frustratingly long static-filled delay.
MPL here. Receiving loud and clear.
Rushmi's voice sounded thin and shaken to Chen. They must already know, he thought.
This is Phobos Ops, MPL. Please confirm that hypercone deployment was at 100%.
This is MPL. Please repeat, Phobos.
The flight director nervously touched her headset again.
This is Phobos. Repeat. We show hypercone deployed at 100%. Please confirm.
Static filled the room again for an even longer period.
This is MPL. Confirmed. Hypercone deployed, 100%. How far short does that bring us in?
This is Phobos Ops. We are calculating that now.
A nervous junior navigator eventually got up and whispered in the controller's ear. She looked around the room, motioning that she wanted work to start on a plan, then with reluctance turned her mic back on.
This is Phobos Ops.
Static.
This is MPL, receiving loud and clear.
There was a small tremor in Rushmi's voice.
This is Phobos Ops. You will come in 450 kilometers short of target, near Lot Crater. Repeat, 450 km short. Your nav computers have been sent. Updated landing coordinates. We are working on options for rendezvous with ground-based rovers. Repeat, with ground-based rovers.
Chen was considering the improbability of that option as the radio link went dead. The flight director turned to the room.
We just went below the horizon and are out of direct radio contact. They may be having trouble doing a mid-flight realignment of their antenna to the COMSAT relays. I'm sure their concerns are elsewhere at the moment. The automated systems will ensure they make it down safely. But,
she furrowed her brow for emphasis,
when we come around into direct radio range again in 4 hours, I want a plan on my desk. If we fail...
She trailed off and left the room. Chen knew. If they failed, aside from the horrific cost in human life, given the unstable conditions on Earth, there would be no further human missions to the surface.
The Phobos engineers are the best alive. They'll think of a plan. I suggest we focus on how to conserve our limited resources.
Rushmi tried to look calm and reassure the crew, but they all knew the implications. Unless the engineers could magically conjure an extended-range Land Rover from the dust of Mars to rescue them, their chances were bleak. No one spoke. Briefly, Rushmi wondered if, when the beacon light had flickered, should he have followed his instinct and taken control. Surely he could have done better than 450 kilometers off course, using his wrist chronometer and pilot's reflexes. But that option was long past. The thrusters automatically kicked in, and the lander started the final leg of its journey. As the craft began to pitch its nose skyward in preparation for the vertical landing, Rushmi saw the light of a star faintly flicker in the dark Martian sky through one of the forward portals. He thought of the myth based on the ancient Roman worship of the planet Venus and made a wish. 20 seconds later, they had landed with an abrupt bounce as the spidery legs of the MPL struggled to absorb the last of their kinetic energy. If only it had been in the right place, it wasn't too bad of a landing, Rashmi thought. The thrusters cut out and all was quiet. Only the hum of the ventilation system and the background chatter of electronics filled the air. For a few minutes everyone sat still, contemplating the fate that chance had apparently dealt them. Then, realizing they were wasting precious power, the crew jumped into a momentary frenzy as they shut down all but the essential systems. The tiny cabin fell into an eerie quiet. They jumped when something knocked three times on the hull, waited, and knocked again. Anya had been discovered soon after the truck left the base. On any other day, the excursion team would have turned around to take her back, but today they needed to be at the site on time. They were mad, but there was nothing they could do about her. Anya had counted on that. She had overheard them talking at lunch the day before. She remembered how adamant they had been about the time. They had only 3.5 hours to finish whatever it was they were supposed to do. The time was of vital importance, although she couldn't guess why. But it was perfect for her needs. The excursion truck bounced over the rough terrain, tossing its occupants into each other as they climbed up to the great plains that surrounded New Greenland. Although she couldn't see them, Anya imagined the sweeper arms trailing behind, erasing their tracks as they went, so no nosy satellite could ever deduce their presence. She had first seen the camouflaged excursion trucks in the garage on a school field trip. They had squatted on the floor, looking more like immovable piles of rocks than vehicles. Her teacher had explained how they could vary their color and shape to fit into the landscape they traversed, and how the sweepers covered their tracks. They were invisible to satellites, giving off no heat and deflecting radar. It was then that Anya had become determined to ride in one, and now she was. When the truck reached the dusty plain, it picked up speed as the crew anxiously checked their watches. One pointed to a screen beside the driver's console.
"Look, there it is, right on time and on target. Just like the simulation predicted. The interruption in the nav beam worked."
The truck briefly moved forward faster, then jerked to a stop. Gwen, the team leader, told them to put on their helmets, and when they were ready, she depressurized the cabin. Three of the adults went out, but Anya was told to stay. Angry that she had been left inside, Anya pushed her way in beside the driver and looked out the front screen. Gwen loped over to a silver and white thing, perched in the center of a blackened ring of regolith. It vaguely reminded Anya of a picture she had once seen of a baby dolphin, but this one stood vertically up on uncertain, delicate, spider-like legs. Gwen climbed a series of steps molded into its shiny side and knocked on a sealed hatch that had a small window in its center. Meanwhile, her companions began to attach cables from the truck to two of the thing's legs. After an extended period of gestured communications, Gwen jumped to the ground. The hatch cracked open, and five bewildered-looking figures wearing bulky orange environment suits emerged one by one from the bowels of the silvery object. Anya was delighted by the sight of the five new people and their gleaming ship. It was all so different from the scruffy, ochre camouflage of the New Greenlanders. The newcomers screamed their presence in the barren plain, daring satellites to spot them. There had been no recruits for almost 70 years, and Anya was excited to be among the first to greet them. Gwen guided the five orange-suited figures into the truck and showed them a row of seats at the back. Anya could see their confused but relieved expressions through their helmet faceplates. They all gestured, questioning hand signs, and Anya realized that their suits did not work on the New Greenland frequency. Gwen indicated for them to wait, then left the truck again. Through the front screen, which was closed off from the rear passenger area, Anya saw Gwen with a portable sweeper coaxing away the trails of footprints. By now, the cables had been attached to the silver ship, and with a hand signal from the crew, the driver backed up. The ship hesitated, then a leg gave way and it crumpled onto its side. There was a flash that ripped it into shards of burnt metal. Anya understood from the driver's expression that she was not to tell their passengers about this. An earth-moving truck crawled up to the site and began to dig a crater-shaped hole around the wreck. Anya knew what would happen. She had seen pictures in school. The camouflage teams were very good at their art. Before the next satellite flew over, it would look like a crash site, and there would be no evidence that anyone had ever been there. Gwen signaled the driver that they were free to go. He swung the truck around and pressurized the cabin. Anya waited for the environment light to turn green, took off her helmet, then ran back to greet the new arrivals. The main screen of the mission room displayed 3 hours and 58 minutes past touchdown. Phobos had risen above the horizon on Mars, but radio contact with the landing site had not been established. The flight director was concerned, but still optimistic.
The MPL might still be having trouble with its antenna. With the last-minute change in landing site, the descent could have been rough,
she stated out loud, as much to bolster her own confidence as everyone else in the room. They'd confirm in 10 minutes when one of the commsats flew over the site. While in Mars shadow, they had decided to launch the last remaining quarter-scale mock-up of the lander, stuffed with supplies, when Phobos emerged from the backside of Mars on their next orbit. At least that would buy them some extra time to come up with a plan, and make them feel like they were still capable of doing something. But when the commsat pictures of the landing site emerged, line by line, they etched all hope away. Chen lowered his head in respect for the sacrifice that the five had made. Instinctively he knew the window had closed. At best, it might take another half century before another attempt was made. At worst, no attempt would be made again. It had been 3 years since O'Day had involuntarily arrived at New Greenland Station. As an exopaleontologist, her research had grown beyond anything she could have ever imagined. She had spent months studying the magnesium carbonate deposits. The results were promising, and there was even talk of setting up a permanent station near the crater basin. The other members of the original Indochina landing crew had equally shared in the benefits in New Greenland, each eventually finding an interest that they could explore to their heart's desire.
Thanks for listening to Make Show Stories 36, Somewhere, Sometime, Lifeboat. We hope you enjoyed the story tonight. As always, we'd love to hear from you, so send us an email at makeshowstories@gmail.com or visit our website at makeshowstories.com. All sound effects are licensed from soundsnap.com, and the opening and closing theme, Glimpse of Happiness, is Pod Safe Music, licensed from premiumbeat.com. Makeshift Stories is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, No Derivative License, which means you're free to share our stories, just remember to credit us and don't alter anything.